And everyone keep your classified in its containers for the moment. We will have the, we will not have the courtroom cleared at this time. We will proceed with the open portion of the argument. There will be further instructions. This is not a test. We will receive further instructions. I would say before we begin, now this is, the courtroom is still open. Nothing is sealed, so I would urge everyone at both council tables, confine the first 10 minutes here, then we'll close after probably 10 minutes to the side, to, don't start his time yet, I'm using it up, so, to those matters that can be discussed in an unclassified atmosphere. If one of us starts to say something that any attorney thinks encroaches on classified material, it will not be rude to raise your hand because we do not wish to disclose anything that should not be disclosed. And then there will come a time when we will seal the courtroom and unseal the classified and take up those portions that may not be discussable here. But for now, at least, we're working on the open record, the public filing, and proceed from there.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The central question that's presented by this appeal is whether there is sufficient, reliable, credible evidence in this record to sustain a finding that the government met its burden under even a preponderance of the evidence standard to prove that Fauzi al-Oda was part of an enemy armed force so as to authorize his indefinite and, as a practical matter, life imprisonment. We submit that the answer to that question is no. The only reliable, credible evidence in this record are the consistent statements that Mr. al-Oda himself made to his interrogators and at his CSRT. And those statements alone about what he was doing in Afghanistan in 2001 do not support the trial court's conclusion. The trial court apparently recognized that fact because it cited other evidence to support its conclusion that he was part of an enemy armed force. But the evidence that the trial court relied upon consisted almost entirely of raw intelligence reports that were cherry-picked by the government, that contained multiple levels of hearsay and no indicia of reliability. Ironically, the trial court itself, in its opinion, recognized that such raw intelligence reports are inherently unreliable. And indeed, as we pointed out in our briefs, the government's own Intelligence 101 declaration submitted in this case and found at the appendix at pages 467 through 506, Intelligence 101 declaration itself says that these raw intelligence reports are merely the first step in what they refer to as the intelligence cycle and are not relied on even by the intelligence community until they are further go through the further four steps of the process, including analysis by trained intelligence analysts. And yet, even though the court recognized in its opinion that such reports are inherently unreliable, and indeed we can see mistakes in these reports, not only in the other cases that we've cited to this court, but in this very case, we can see demonstrable mistakes in these reports, the court ended up relying precisely on this kind of material to reach its conclusion that Mr. al-Oda was part of an enemy armed force. We submit, Your Honors, that it was legal error for the court to rely on such evidence, and therefore its decision should be vacated and the case should be reversed with instructions to grant Mr. al-Oda's habeas petition. Now, what do Mr. Allota's statements to his interrogators and at his CSRT indicate?
Can we just start with the law questions for just 1 second?
Certainly, Your
Honor. Is everybody here in agreement that the legal challenges you raise are for the record, but recognizing we have a precedent that it goes against you?
No, Your Honor. As we said in our reply brief, we believe that the decisions of the Al-Bahani panel on the questions of burden of proof and hearsay are dicta. Judge Williams, in his concurring opinion, said as much, and it is clear. I think it's actually very useful to contrast the Al-Bahani case with this case, because in that case, you have a detainee who, by his own statements, said, yes, I was part of...
I always like to start with the law, then we'll get to the fact.
Your Honor, and
if we thought, I mean, the majority in that case didn't say it was dicta. I appreciate the concurrence said it was dicta, but the majority didn't.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And if we believe, contrary to your interest, that we are required to follow the view of the majority in that case, is there any more to the law that we need to discuss here? That's an easy thing to discuss in the open, so that's why I raise it.
Certainly. Yes, there is, Your Honor. And I would like to push back a little on the fact that even if the majority didn't say it was dicta.
Counsel, okay. Please answer the questions that are asked.
Sorry, Your Honor. The other thing that we would have to address, even if we conclude that it's not dicta, is our argument with respect to the admissibility of hearsay raises an issue that was not presented to the Al-Bahani panel. And that
How about Hamdi?
Excuse me?
How about the Hamdi plurality in the Supreme Court? Did they not strongly suggest these cases would be decided on hearsay?
Your Honor, the plurality suggested that hearsay might be necessary, but it did not suggest that any kind of hearsay without regard to the exceptions. In the Hamdi plurality case, they were considering that in the context of a declaration. In that case, it was, remember, the mob's declaration, which the government had submitted. Declarations, i.e. affidavits, are recognized exceptions under the habeas statute that can be used.
What's the hearsay argument you're making is a rules argument?
Yes, Your Honor. What we're saying in the hearsay argument is that the federal rules of evidence make clear that they apply except to the extent that they're made inapplicable by statute. The habeas statute, section 2246, does permit affidavits, which is different than in the typical civil case. It does permit affidavits at the discretion of the court. What we're arguing, Your Honor, is that any hearsay beyond affidavits has to be justified by some exception under the rules of evidence, and we submit that the trial court had no authority to disregard the rules of evidence. And we don't think that Hamdi suggested that the rules of evidence could be disregarded in habeas cases. I think that there's no dispute here that the habeas statute governs. And the habeas statute is very clear as to what hearsay may be admitted and what hearsay may not be admitted. There was no effort by the government to prove its case by affidavits, nor was there any effort by the government even to meet the standards that were set by the district court in the overall procedural order that governs this case. The district court...
In Al-Bahani, they probably couldn't, other than citing that rule, they couldn't have more strongly rejected that argument, right? They say that the rules of evidence don't have to apply here. We don't have to protect the eyes of the impression... The eyes of the judge from the eyes of the impressionable juries. In a detainee case, the judge acts as a neutral decision maker. This is why the one constant in the history of habeas has never been a certain set of procedures, but rather the independent power of a judge to assess the actions. And then it goes on and explains Boumediene and the other cases and Hamdi talking about hearsay. So your argument is that they're wrong.
Well,
but other than that, I'm not saying... Regardless of whether they're right or wrong, they are a precedent.
Your Honor, what I'm saying is that the argument we've presented, if you look at the briefs and the argument in Al-Bahani, the argument we presented that the court is foreclosed from allowing hearsay beyond what's allowed in the statute was never presented to the court. And so even if it was a finding
they did hold that in specifically in habeas, hearsay can be reviewed.
Yes, they did, Your Honor. But I'm saying, and I think that the precedent we cited in our reply brief supports the fact that when a court makes a decision, but it's not based on an argument that has been presented to the court, that a subsequent panel can consider that argument because it's never been considered.
How is your hearsay argument different than Bahani's was?
Your Honor,
the court expressly refers to Bahani's hearsay challenge. He was attacking the use of hearsay. And it looks like, from what the court was reciting, it was very much like your challenge.
Your Honor, what was different about it is he was attacking the use of hearsay because it didn't meet the reliability standards that were set in the case management order set in this case. There's no argument in the briefs, either on the government side or the appellant side in the Bahani case, that the habeas statute and the rules themselves foreclose the use of hearsay of the sort relied on here. And that's basically our point. I mean, it was simply not an argument.
The court certainly cited the federal rules of evidence in dealing with his arguments. I mean, I haven't read his briefs, but it looks like an opinion that's dealing with that argument.
Your Honor, it certainly cites the federal rules of evidence, but in a different context. What it says, it's citing the federal rules of evidence, as Judge Garland read, to say, basically the federal rules of evidence don't impose the same kind of restrictions on a judge than it would on a jury. We don't have to shield the judge. That's not the argument we're making here. The argument we're making here, again, which I do not believe was presented in either the briefs or the argument in Bahani, is that the federal rules of evidence unquestionably apply to these proceedings, these Guantanamo proceedings. The federal rules of evidence do not permit the kind of multi-level, unsupported hearsay that was submitted by the government that the government did not even attempt to fit into any hearsay exception. So our argument is that even if the court accepts Bahani as precedent and not dicta, we think that given the fact that this argument that we made in our case was not presented before, entitles this panel to take another look at the hearsay issue.
Let me ask you, prior to Bahani, we had Parhat discussing hearsay and the nature of that evidence such that the trier of fact would need to be able to determine the reliability of the evidence, the hearsay evidence. Sort of what say you to that argument?
Your Honor, first of all, I agree that even, and I think even al-Bahani recognizes this, that even if hearsay is allowable, the court needs to consider the reliability of the hearsay evidence. I think that Parhat is not relevant to this legal issue of whether hearsay is admissible because Parhat arose under that.
I totally agree. But I'm just trying to get to this reliability point.
Right.
Because you've heard some pullback on your other arguments, so I thought, well, let's see what you have to say about this other argument.
Well, Your Honor, and I appreciate that because, as I say, I think that under al-Bahani and Parhat, even if the government is permitted to dump whatever hearsay it wants into the case, it is still the court's obligation, as the trier of fact, to determine whether that hearsay is credible and reliable.
Well, I know the government's motion was sort of a dump motion, but is that the way this case proceeded?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. The government, in its motion, never made any attempt to meet even the requirements of the case management order, and the court did not require them to do so. We objected to virtually all of the government's hearsay evidence. What the court said is that the court deferred the ruling on that and said she would consider the evidence in the context of ruling on the case. But I think...
Yeah, and that, counsel, is not unusual in non-jury trials, that to let the evidence in and say, I'll consider the rulings when I'm ruling on the case.
Your Honor, I agree. I think it is unusual in a regular case.
It's not unusual in non-jury trials.
No, it's not unusual, but in non-jury trials, typically the court will exercise its discretion to find that hearsay meets some exception to the hearsay rule.
Well, in the al-Bahani opinion, and I hate to take you back to the first part of your argument. No, I don't. I don't hate to. I'm going to do it. Therefore, the question the habeas court must ask when presented with hearsay is not whether it is admissible. It is always admissible, but what probative value to ascribe to whatever indicia of reliability it exhibits. This approach is evident in the relevant case. Boumediene did, and it goes on then to the Supreme Court authorities on it. So doesn't that... answer your first question and get us to Judge Rogers' question of whether what you really should be talking about is whether it's reliable or not, not whether it was admissible or not.
Your Honor, I'm happy to go to the reliability. I was addressing the admissibility question because it is raised in our briefs, and I did want to indicate in response to Judge Garland's questions that we are not conceding that Al-Bahani forecloses the question. I may not have persuaded the court on that. Indeed, I probably haven't. But I wanted to at least give it a try. But going to Judge Rogers' question, it is always necessary for the court to determine credibility and reliability. And I see no indication in the trial court's opinion that although the trial court said that the reliability of this evidence would be considered in the context of the decision, I see no indication that it was. The trial court, for example, relies very heavily on these cherry-picked interrogation reports of other detainees who the trial court said took similar routes into Afghanistan as Mr. Al-Oda. Now, there's no indication in there that the trial court determined that any of those interrogation reports had any reliability.
Be careful now as we talk about these. I'm not sure precisely where the classified line comes, but...
Your Honor, I can say that the briefs, ultimately the government has declassified about 98% of the briefs. The only thing really left to be classified are names, and I do not intend to use any names.
I'm clear. In looking at the district court's opinion, she had basically three rulings here. One was about this trip to Dubai.
Yes.
All right, and she relied on petitioner's statement, one of them, and the passport.
Yes.
All right, and then she made a credibility determination.
Yes.
Then she went on to the travels, and she looks at what she finds to be a conflict between counsel's statement and petitioner's statement about leaving now, leaving later. All right. Then when she goes to the geography, I mean, we can take judicial notice of some of the geography, it seems to be. But I want to be clear exactly what she relied on in regard to some of the other areas. Now, some of this is classified, I know. So if we get into this, maybe later on we can come back to that. Then she goes on to look at several of the petitioner's statements, and she makes certain conclusions about that. So until we get to what you were just talking about, the route where she's relying on these interrogation reports, as I read her opinion, she was trying to avoid making rulings where there wasn't what I'll call third-party independent evidence, like a passport or the petitioner's own statements. Now, whether she drew the right conclusions from the petitioner's statements is a different issue, because credibility is a funny thing where there's no live witness.
I agree, Your Honor.
So your basic argument under reliability is, one, the intelligence reports, given the government's own concessions and its documents about their unreliability.
Yes.
And two, what, misreading or misinterpretation of petitioner's statements?
The one is the reliance. I do think that the trial court relied on third-party statements to reach her conclusions that what Mr. Al-Oda doing was other than what he said. With respect, it's not so much misinterpretation of Mr. Al-Oda's statements, Your Honor. Our position there is that the trial court quite apparently did not believe Mr. Al-Oda's explanations. Our position is that disbelief is not a substitute for affirmative proof to the contrary. In other words, it's the government that had the burden of proof here.
But I thought what she was saying was, well, he's made certain admissions And you're saying she's not allowed to rely on that?
No, she's allowed to rely on the admissions, Your Honor. What I'm saying that what she determined that he admitted, those statements, those admissions, in and of themselves, if you look at them, do not provide a basis for concluding that he was a member of an enemy armed force.
I see.
Let me give you an example, if I may, Your Honor. Let me give you one example that's not in any way classified, but just to give you an example, because I think one of the problems here, Your Honor, it's very easy in these cases and very dangerous to look at evidence with preconceptions that we all have and that are hard to get out of our minds. And I'll give you one example. Mr. Al-Oda paid cash for his, when he got to Dubai, paid cash for his ticket to go to Pakistan.
Let me stop you just one second. I do think we've gotten close to the classified already. Are you very sure that what you're getting into is not going to get any classified information?
Your Honor,
I am not sure that we crossed over, but I think we got close at least.
Your Honor, I am, but I will say this. I know it would be much easier for the court to be able to question me, and I have no
problem. Why don't we leave?
We have no problem.
Well, I have a legal question.
Okay, let's get the legal question and leave that part for the
court. We certainly have no problem going into closed session, so the court can.
And just outlining this for myself, I gather there's no dispute about the definition the district court adopted for the scope of the president's detention authority. The government hasn't filed a cross appeal on that. The use of hearsay, we've talked about that. The standard, you argue that given that we're talking about the possibility of indefinite detention, the standard should not be a preponderance of evidence, but should be clear and convincing evidence.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And the cases you cite all involve statutes where Congress had imposed a clear and convincing standard. Now, we don't have that here, at least not yet.
That is correct, Your Honor. I don't believe that the Addington case involved a statute.
Addington?
Addington versus Texas. That's a Supreme Court case involving
sexual?
No, that's Kansas versus Hendricks is the sexual predator statute.
I'll look at that then. Yeah, I thought I had read all your cases.
The Addington versus Texas, see if I can get you the cite quickly. It's a Supreme Court decision on involuntary civil commitment, 441 U.S. 418, and this is where the Supreme Court. I believe actually there was. Now that I think about it, I think that this did involve a state statute.
Yeah.
But the Supreme Court ruled that the statutory standard there was insufficient given the societal interest. That's the point. The Supreme Court overruled the statutory burden in that case, and said that the societal the liberty interest is sufficiently strong and fundamental that no one should be civilly committed on less than a clear and convincing standard, and it overruled the state statute. And we recognize, Your Honor, that there are no precedents that are exactly like this. These cases
Bahani is a lot like this. What did Bahani say about the burden of proof?
Your Honor, as I say, if the court concludes that Bahani's precedent, I'm done. But if the court is willing to consider that al-Bahani on the burden of proof is not precedent, then I think that there's
not precedent because it's dicta or why?
Yes,
that's the reason.
Because as Judge Williams pointed out,
not necessary for the decision.
Right, it was not necessary for their decision. Mr. al-Bahani admitted, in effect, that he was part of an enemy armed force. There was
so if in the concurrent.
Can I just continue on this standard? Now, the Supreme Court, in talking, not necessarily in the habeas context only, was talking about concerns with these core aspects. In some instances, I realize talking about due process, but the court has continued to talk about getting notice of the charges, opportunity to offer evidence before a neutral tribunal. And in our record here, the public record, there is a statement identified as your client's statement before a CSRT. What is the date of that CSRT?
Unfortunately, we don't know, Your Honor. There's no.
All right, I will ask the government that. And do we know whether he's had more than one?
I'm virtually certain he has had only one CSRT. There have been what's called ARBs, Administrative
Review
Boards.
That's right. I wanted to ask if those are still done every year.
I I think that they ceased, the new administration implemented this...
New scheme, so those are gone.
Interagency task force, that's right. There are no further ARBs.
All right. And here, the original habeas petition...
Yes.
...filed May 1, 2005, do you remember the date?
2002.
Yes, asked for different types of relief. And then there was an amended complaint that this court has interpreted in a way to say that your client is requesting his immediate release.
That is correct, Your Honor, because these are the oldest cases on the docket. These were filed before the determination in Rasul that habeas was available.
All right. Now, in the Al-Oda decision by Judge Joyce Green, way back at the very beginning, she talks about this question of evidence and rejected there the government's argument about some evidence would be sufficient. So when the government files a motion that's a sort of a dump type motion and let the court wade through it and figure out what sticks to the wall, that to me strikes pretty much what Judge Green was getting at about a some evidence standard. So I read the case management order to say we're not looking at hearsay, we're not looking at this preponderance standard in that sense. All right, we're using this traditional preponderance standard. So when there is evidence that requires inferences to be drawn, what is the government's burden in terms of showing the reliability of that evidence on which the district court relies? That's what I'm not clear about in your argument.
Your Honor, I think the government's burden, well, first of all, I think that if the requirements of the case management order are followed, the government had two burdens. First of all, it had to show that the hearsay it was being offered because it would be unduly burdensome to offer better evidence, if you will, and in addition that to offer that better evidence would unduly impact national security. The government made no effort whatsoever. In fact, as far as I know, the government has made no effort to comply with that standard in any of the Guantanamo habeas cases. They've just disregarded that case management order requirement. The trial court here did not explicitly hold the government to that. I think that the trial court, to some extent, did. Judge Rogers, I think you've pointed out that to some extent the trial court tried to avoid relying on some of this unreliable hearsay. For example, and again, without stating any names or anything else, you can see that the court rejected, I think, properly the accusations of these highly unreliable informants. But I think the court, despite itself, fell into the trap of relying on unreliable hearsay where it cited these various raw interrogation reports of other detainees and then said...
Now, there's a difference between unreliable and less than completely reliable and false.
Yes.
We have no reason to believe that what she relied on is false. It's just a matter of her assessing its reliability, and I'm not sure why we would be any better at that than her.
Well, in fact,
I think from Bessemer forward, at least, even on documentary evidence, we're supposed to assume the district court, I'm paraphrasing, but is expert on finding facts, and we're not. We defer to them if there's evidence. Well, you seem to be wanting us to reassess the reliability and reweigh the evidence.
No, Your Honor, I want you to look at the reliability ab initio, if you will, and let me give you an example. And again, this is not classified. The trial court looked at various individual interrogation statements of various detainees who the trial court then relied upon to say that these detainees went to Afghanistan for jihad. Mr. Al-Oda used a similar route, therefore, more likely than not, that he went for jihad. Well, I submit, Your Honor, as a matter of law, not a question of the judge assessing the evidence, as a matter of law, reaching that conclusion from a single interrogation statement of a detainee without knowing anything more is not a basis for doing that. And the clear example of that in this case is...
Obviously, she didn't do that. She had all kind of other evidence there.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. In the case...
She didn't look at one single... The evidence before her was not just one single statement. That's not the case. She had a thick book of evidence in front of her.
Your Honor, that thick book of...
And it's all taken in light of each other.
Your Honor, that thick book of evidence consisted largely of...
We all know what it consisted
right,
of.
Right.
And but I think we're...
Can I ask one more law question?
Sure.
I just want to understand the implications of your hearsay argument. So your argument is the rule applies in habeas just as if it were a trial, correct?
A habeas trial, yes, which permits...
Well, it's just as if it would be any trial, your argument is, a habeas trial as in any trial?
Well, the difference, Your Honor, is that the habeas statute specifically permits affidavits. I think a regular trial would not normally permit affidavits.
An affidavit of the person who would otherwise be speaking, or what?
I think it's broader than that. The habeas statute simply says that affidavits are permitted in the discretion of the court, but then they can be subject to interrogatories, et cetera. I think it gives the court discretion, and Hamdi suggests that...
I don't want to hear about Hamdi. I just want to hear what you mean about the rule. So when you say an affidavit... Could your opposing counsel say, this is the evidence that we believe is established as a result of the attached documents? That's their affidavit, or it has to be the person who would otherwise be testifying? What do you mean by an affidavit?
I think it would have to be the person who could establish some basis for the court to judge the reliability of the evidence. For example, an interrogation statement. Ideally, if you had the subject of the interrogation.
I don't want to go to the ideal. That's why I really want, I'm trying to figure out exactly how hard this issue is.
It could be an affidavit of the interrogator himself, not necessarily of the,
Could the interrogator say, Mr. X told me that Mr. Y told him that Mr. Z said K? That is,
yeah,
you know,
right.
Multiple hearsay incorporated.
Right.
The only problem is it's not in the form of an affidavit. Is that?
Your Honor, I think the interrogator's affidavit would get you only the first step. If those other statements in the chain were not subject to some exception, no, I don't think they would be admitted.
You need an affidavit from every one of those people.
Yes, or Your Honor, there is, after all, a catch-all exception under the federal rules.
Aren't you right back up against the El-Bahani language again, though, that I read to you a while ago? The question that a habeas court must ask when presented with hearsay is not whether it is admissible. Daesh, it is always admissible, Daesh, but what probative weight to ascribe to whatever indicia of reliability it exhibits?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if Al-Bahani controls...
If Al-Bahani controls...
Then you lose this issue. And, right?
and if Al-Bahani controls, and if you don't accept the fact that we presented a different argument, yes, then we lose this issue.
But I don't think even Al-Bahani reaches what I'm trying to get at here. All right, now, following up on Judge Garland's question, couldn't there be an affidavit that says, detainee A has made this statement, and the government has evidence that indicates that this is a reliable statement, that, you know, it's like a confidential informant where a detective signs an affidavit. We've used this informant on many occasions. He's proven to be reliable. As distinct from what we have here is what I will call a raw statement, where we have no idea, as we did in some of the other statements, that there was bias involved. So that the district court said she wasn't going to rely on those. So that I don't think, I mean, to the extent that the Supreme Court and our court has talked about this is war, the burdens on, you know, military officers, et cetera, the burdens on the government, I'm just wondering whether you said to Judge Garland, well, get an affidavit from the detainee, but that doesn't solve the reliability problem, does it?
Not in and of itself. I mean, the affidavit Your Honor's talking about would certainly give more indicia of reliability. It could also be tested, though. Remember, under the habeas statute, we'd be allowed to test that affidavit, which we couldn't do with the kind of raw intelligence reports here.
See, I read the government's motion, and the government can tell me if I'm wrong, is that they wanted a dump process where they would make no representation about reliability whatsoever. And then the burden was on the petitioner to come forth with specific, probative, reliable evidence to attack this dump evidence. And the district court rejected that. She allowed all this evidence in, but she didn't place a burden on your client, as I read her opinion.
Your Honor, I think that that was her intention, not to place the burden on our client. As I say, I think the way she ended up relying on many of these raw intelligence reports ended up, in effect, placing the burden on our client. But I can discuss that more in the closed session.
Okay, is anything further we need to ask him in open session? We've probably got his knees wobbling by now anyway, as long as we've had him up. So, if not, then, counsel, we'll hear from the government as to the matters of open session.
May it please the court, Charles Scarborough, Department of Justice. With me is Robert Loeb, also from DOJ. Addressing the hearsay issue, it's our position, as stated in our briefs, that al-Bihani forecloses the challenge rather clearly. Al-Bihani addressed the hearsay problem.
What did it say? It said it's admissible. It's always relevant.
It said specifically it is always admissible.
Doesn't talk about reliability.
I'm sorry?
Doesn't talk about the reliability issue that I've been focusing on.
Well, your reliability issues, again, I think reliability goes to exactly the way the district court assessed this case. Did not accept the government, as you've been characterizing. Wouldn't think it's fair to characterize the government's presentation of evidence as a document dump here.
But that's what your motion proposed.
No, the motion actually, it requested a presumption of accuracy and authenticity.
Yes.
The district court rejected that.
Of whatever government submits.
I understand that. And the district court took
that's
a different
approach. That's what I call a dump.
But the district court took a different approach here.
I know. But there wasn't any representation by the government that the evidence it was submitting, it deemed to be reliable. That's what I'm trying to focus on.
Well, again, the type of evidence here, I think it's important to distinguish between the type of evidence that this court found unreliable in Parhat, which was essentially, intelligence from a single source, primarily China in that case, that had sort of a reason to be biased against people, as opposed to the evidence in this case, which consists primarily of interrogation reports of this person, who could very well come forward and rebut and say all manner of things were mistranscribed or misstated. So we're talking about, you can characterize it as raw evidence, but it's really the most reliable type of evidence. It's an interpreter.
I'm not focusing on the petitioner's statements. I'm focusing on the statements that counsel referred to, for example, that the district court relied on in terms of the route.
Well, again, they're not statements by the petitioner. But they are still, I would submit, some of the most reliable kinds of raw, if you will, evidence.
But
they're intelligence reports with a guy sitting in a room saying, this is what this guy is telling me.
Yeah, but who is this guy? Is he reliable or not?
Well,
we have no idea.
Again,
your own documents say that you don't rely on this type of evidence until it's gone through several steps of testing.
Our own documents do not say that these intelligence reports are unreliable, and they certainly... the government does rely on these for certain propositions. Again, the idea that somehow, as Judge Garland was exploring with counsel for the petitioner, somehow forcing everyone to come in with a declaration, introducing another level of hearsay that said, yes, this person said on X date 8 years ago to me this thing, doesn't really help matters. And it's interesting or important to note, I think, that the Supreme Court, when it was dealing with the hearsay problem in Mohamdi and saying hearsay may well be the type of evidence that you have to rely upon, was looking at that very sort of declaration. The mob's declaration was essentially just a summation of a bunch of intelligence reports. So it was another level of hearsay. And I'm not sure how that makes it sort of any more reliable. And the point is the government made a showing and has consistently made showings that this is the type of evidence. These intelligence reports, especially when you're sitting down with a detainee, and saying what happened, and they are transcribing what happened. Yes, there are asides in some of these documents, and I'm not going to get into particulars. There are asides where you see very clearly the analyst says something like, we don't think this is credible because of X. And the district court, in making a case-by-case, document-by-document assessment, is free to give that some weight in some occasions and, to discard it in other occasions. That's the type of approach.
The government had information that detainee X gave this statement, but the detainee X had his own agenda.
Well, I mean, the government is under a general duty to disclose exculpatory evidence here. So if we have a witness that...
And we have an opinion also entitled El Oda, which says that.
Yes. Right?
There's a discovery requirement. There, with respect to discovery, you have to produce this Brady-like material.
That's right, Your Honor. And so the point is, Your
but
Honor...
in this case, evidence came in where detainee statements, it was demonstrated they had other agendas.
Well, the point is the detainee would be able to challenge that sort of evidence. The government would have a duty to disclose that sort of evidence. If for instance, a particular witness, you know, was tortured or there was some sort of coercion involved, or that particular witness has been deemed unreliable in another proceeding, the government has a duty to disclose those things. And that is the type of evidence, you know, that a district court, as a fact finder, could appropriately shy away from or discard altogether.
And that is what the district court did here.
Absolutely.
Where there was that kind of evidence, the district court either disregarded or weighed low the value of the evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. As you pointed out, Judge Rogers, earlier, there was, I think it is fair to characterize the district court judge here as trying, to the extent possible, to base her opinion on the admissions by this petitioner in his own interrogation reports, which are, of course, the thing that he could most easily challenge. He could say, no, I didn't say that, or that's not right. There are some corroborating details that fill in at the margins, but I think, you know, to the extent that there may be a dispute about that, the district court, you know, really tried to focus in on the core of the petitioner's own admissions.
And what's our standard of review where the district court's looking at pieces of paper and evaluating them, and we're looking at the same pieces of paper?
Bessemer, as Judge Sintel pointed out earlier, makes clear that the standard review is still clear error. And
where it's all written?
Yes, it does. I mean, to the extent that there was contrary precedent earlier, Anderson versus City of Bessemer really forecloses that sort of argument. And the reason for that is that it's not just, district courts aren't just expert in judging demeanor. They're experts in finding facts, and they live with the case for a much longer period. They have,
I'll give you an example.
Sure.
What concerns me, for example, is the petitioner has some statements as to how long was he in Dubai, all right?
Yes.
He says a few days.
He says different things at different places.
District court says he says a few days, all right? And the district court says she doesn't credit that because the passport shows
I'm also a little bit worried that we're entering into a classified session. I'm not sure the passport contents have been unclassified.
I would like to
classified session, please.
I would like to address all I can in the public session, but I do.
Let's leave the detailed facts if we can for the classified session.
Sure. I mean, I think the sort of the last point, to the extent we're talking about hearsay and the legal matter, our position is that the arguments are foreclosed and have been dealt with by Bahani, and that just coming up with a new sort of subsidiary argument about why hearsay should be generally inadmissible is not something this panel can, you know, overrule the prior panel decision. And I think it's also important to note out, Judge Garland, you were discussing the implications of the hearsay argument from the other side. It really would impose a lot of burdens, and it would, to very little practical effect, having these declarations come in that sort of, you know, create an extra level of hearsay wouldn't really serve much purpose at this point. And I think that's something that the Supreme Court has recognized in Hamdi and also in Boumediene in recognizing that, you know, what we're trying to preserve is the core of habeas for meaningful review. And you do get meaningful review here. You get to challenge, in particular in a case like this where most of the evidence is your own admissions in your own interrogation reports, you have the ability to challenge that. The petitioner in this case did not put in a declaration. The petitioner relied on the very same hearsay that the government's relying on. And the district court, as fact finder, drew inferences from the admissions in those statements. So unless there's anything further on legal points.
Can we leave factual then for...
Government's not contesting the district court's definition of the president's power to detain, is it?
Not in this case. I wouldn't
know. All right. That's all I would need to know.
I won't say anything further.
All right.
All right.
I want to ask
you. Okay. One more moment of rebuttal in open session, and then.
So this is on the hearsay question. The rule that says, and I'm Westlawing as fast as I can, the rule that says that federal rules of evidence apply to habeas. That rule applies both to federal state habeas and federal habeas over federal cases. Is that right?
Federal rule of evidence 1101, Your Honor?
The rule that you're citing for the proposition that we have to apply the federal rules and therefore including the hearsay rules to habeas, this would apply to a state prisoner seeking federal habeas as well as to a federal prisoner seeking federal habeas.
Yes, it would apply to any federal habeas case.
Okay. So, very fast Westlawing. There's a Supreme Court opinion in 1995 called Schlupp versus D'Lo, 513 U.S. 298. I'm just trying to find exactly the citation, which it says that the rules don't apply in habeas. Now, maybe the Supreme Court's wrong, but they do have the advantage of being the Supreme Court. Now, let me just read it to you and tell me why this isn't an answer to your point. Hold on just one second. Sorry, it's at 327. Just saw it. I'm sorry. Hold on one second. I'll find it. It's not that easy. Yeah. In assessing the adequacy of a habeas petitioner showing, in this case, it's a habeas petitioner showing, therefore, the district court is not bound by the rules of admissibility that would govern in trial. Rather, this I really like, since I clerked for him, we believe that Judge Friendly's description of the inquiry is appropriate. The habeas court must make its determination concerning the petitioner's innocence in light of all the evidence, including that alleged to have been illegally admitted, for example, but with due regard to any unreliability, which is Judge Rogers' point, and of course the government doesn't disagree with that. So the Supreme Court certainly is indicating, even in a criminal habeas case, even a very standard one, that the general rules of admissibility don't apply. In fact, they don't apply so far that you can look at illegally obtained evidence. So why should it be that we have to strictly follow the habeas rules in this case? Hearsay rule.
Hearsay rule.
Your Honor, I'm sorry, since I'm not familiar with the case, and only, but I would say from what Your Honor read, I mean, just a couple things.
Yes.
First of all, the difference in a habeas case from a criminal conviction, of course, is the petitioner has already had the full due process.
I understand the theoretical differences, and the government would say the difference here is we're in a war, and it's a lot more difficult to obtain affidavits and non-hearsay statements. So there's sort of a policy argument on each side. I didn't understand you to be making any policy argument. Your argument is purely the rules say no hearsay, and that's the rule.
Right. And I guess the other thing I was going to say, Your Honor, is from the excerpt that you read, I didn't hear that as saying that the rules of evidence don't apply. Illegally obtained evidence might well fit within one of the hearsay exceptions. I don't know what that particular evidence was. I think that saying that there's broader admissibility is a different issue than saying the rules of evidence apply. But again, if
okay, fair enough.
If you wish, if it's important to the court, we'd be happy to make a subsequent submission on this issue if this is an important issue for the court.
I think it's something we can deal with our own research, but I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. I think at this point, then, it would be appropriate to clear the courtroom, the court take a brief recess. All those who are not entitled to be here under the clearance procedures would then have to leave. Those who have classified material can open it up, and those who are holding it for the judges can bring it to the bench and leave it for us, and we'll get it when we get back here in a few minutes. So clerk's office will advise us when the courtroom is cleared and we're ready to once again proceed. Give us a recess.